stumbled toward him and knelt beside him. He tried to staunch the blood flow with his shaking hands, but it was like trying to plug a flood with a finger.
"Where's the person who gave you that computer?" Ed asked.
To his surprise, the man opened his eyes slowly and met Ed's gaze. He could tell the wounded individual was in a dangerous state of shock, the kind that precluded only a few seconds left to live.
"I've no idea what you're talking about."
"He must have taught you how to use it. Come on, please! We could stop all of this!"
He gestured with impotence at the battle raging outside the room.
"Right now!"
The old man frowned as if he could tell that something wasn't right.
"We did it ourselves. Someone built the heroes. Perhaps an Inquisitor. Taught us how to use them at some point. Gave us the technology. He wanted..."
He shrugged weakly.
"That makes no sense. That's a laptop from Earth. There was a summoned hero."
Ed could see the old man was about to die. The evil eye blazed with terrible anger born out of desperation.
"Tell me the truth!"
he bellowed, using a minor order spell. In his desperation, he ignored the fact that minor order definitely wasn't meant to be used this way, since demanding someone to speak truthfully wasn't minor in any measure. And at once, a sense of doom overcame him, passing him by as if the feathery wings of the Angel of Death had brushed against his heart. For one brief instant, he was colder than he'd ever been in his entire life, like something huge and vast had reached out to crush him into nothingness and then had, at the last second, decided it wasn't worth the effort. Yet. The dying man chuckled bleakly.
"You know, if I hadn't been telling the truth, you would have broken objectivity's rules, erased from history."
He took one deep, ugly, throaty breath, and then something like clarity glinted in his eyes.
"I should have lied. I could have done the world a favor."
The fake summoned hero died in Ed's arms, but his words awoke in Ed a terrible realization that overcame the Dungeon Lord and made all his plans and hopes for the future, a future that had been impossible since the beginning, collapse around him and vanish. It was the first warning Heron had given him about Ivalice. No one can break objectivity's rules, not the gods, and certainly not bright-eyed men from Earth that thought they could change a world they barely understood. Today, he'd almost suffered the consequences of abusing objectivity for one small mistake. For how long had the summoned hero been in Ivalice? According to Yarlan's story, the hero's creation had taken many years. In that time, a curious man from Earth may commit several minor mistakes. And luck didn't last forever. The man in the Shadow Tarot must have been just like Ed, proud and playing with forces he didn't fully understand. Eventually, those forces retaliated. The summoned hero wasn't in hiding. He had tried to fight the heavens, and for that, he'd paid the ultimate price. There would be no peace. The card in Ed's pocket was the product of an unintended interaction between objectivity and a legendary artifact. It would never come to pass. Dungeon Lord Edward Wright struck the floor with bloody fists and screamed at the sky until his voice gave out. Chapter 28. The Man from Earth. A group of inquisitors and militant soldiers had managed to fight their way into the main garden in the middle of the mansion where a powerful spellcaster stood above a summoning circle. The spellcaster, a short, fat man with a feminine face, grunted with effort as he maintained a sort of bubble around the circle, a heroic ranked version of Circle of Respite, which kept Ed's forces away from the survivors inside. The bubble was littered with the corpses of Haga Anashi and spider warriors alike, including a few princesses. Gloriosa and the rest of her cluster surrounded the area, spread out to limit the effect of a fireball in case the spellcaster dropped the bubble and attacked. The Hagayanashi did the same, their blowpipes and knives at the ready. Ed regarded them all with cold eyes as he slowly walked down the stairs. The men and women inside the bubble saw him approach with a mixture of reactions. Anger, fear, raw hatred. One of the inquisitors, a broad-shouldered man wielding a warhammer and wearing a breastplate over an expensive tunic stained with blood, snarled at Ed and tried to shoulder his way past the spellcaster.
"That's Wraith! Drop your spell, Hatter, so I can end him!"
Hatter shook his head while a pearl of sweat traveled down his double chin.
"No, that's my last heroic spell," he whispered.
"Then let us retreat already before they figure out a way to get us!"
exclaimed a woman dressed in the same tunic and silver mantle as the other two. Again, Hatter shook his head.
"No, Barthody, not without him."
Ed ignored it all. He strolled forward until he was only a few feet away from the bubble.
"Lord Wraith,"
said one of Gloriosa's surviving princesses.
"It's dangerous."
"If Hatter drops the shield, kill them all," Ed said simply, without taking his gaze away from the circle.
The Inquisitors seemed undeterred, but the circle stayed up.
"Yes, my lord."
"You piece of..."
began Warhammer Man. Ed raised the blood-stained laptop he was clutching with his right hand up above his head for everyone to see. Warhammer Man shut up, paling visibly when he recognized the machine.
"You may not remember this. Not so many years ago, Alita, or whoever of her underlings you're on speaking terms with, brought you a man from Earth to help you fight the Dungeon Lords from Lotia. Back then, you were losing the war."
Behind Ed, the fires of Undercity raged on. Black storm clouds hid the twin moons, and thunder roared in the distance. The air was so heavy with static that he could smell the incoming storm. It was going to be a big one. One to remember.
"This person figured out a way to shatter the Dungeon Lord's advantage while killing as few people as possible. Only you forgot to tell him the other side also has innocent people, didn't you? He automated the process of war. He created the heroes using your kingdom's resources, then field-tested and upgraded them until they were ready. When most of your inquisitors failed to learn how to manipulate a keyboard, he decided to use people from our home world instead."
This was conjecture, but based on his experience, even people born in a world with computers oftentimes never bothered to learn the very basics. In a world without electricity, it was probably several orders of magnitude worse.
"It probably helped that objectivity is more lenient with people from a different world, to a point."
In fact, it was the key to the way the heroes worked, because even if controlled at a distance, if someone from Ivalis was the one controlling the hero as it earned, say, 100 experience points, those would go to him. Swords didn't level up, and heroes were little more than animated tools. But Ed knew that objectivity rewarded risk. An inquisitor sitting inside a castle 1,000 miles away from any danger would earn pretty much none of those 100 points. Instead, by using people from Earth, which objectivity couldn't reach, the summoned hero had found a way to let his creations, the heroic constructs themselves, to absorb the points and use them to amplify their own ley lines instead. In other words, the summoned hero had found a way to make the heroes count as living creatures when it came to earning experience points. But it was that very same stunt that had gotten the summoned hero erased from history. After all, objectivity often was flexible. But it had its limits, and the summoned hero had created thousands of heroes and changed the balance of history to one side. And he'd paid the price. Had he even known? Had the Inquisition even bothered to warn him about the risks?
"Creating the heroic system destroyed your summoned hero. Not that you care," Ed said. "His creations stayed behind, and so did the training that he managed to impart on a few of you. Witlands, you probably like it better like this. I know there are ways to figure out when objectivity has annihilated someone close to you, otherwise Ivalians wouldn't ever know it's a danger."
He could see something akin to shame, for an instant, showing its ugly head in the spellcaster Hatter. It was all the confirmation Ed needed.
"You suspect what happened, but choose not to think further about it, because the heroes are now yours to command instead of belonging to someone who doesn't understand your ways. Someone who may not have been as bloodthirsty as you are.
Don't you dare speak to us about bloodthirst, Dungeon Lord, when your hands are slick with the blood of our people,
the woman named Barthany told him.
Fuck you. You did this,
Ed said, pointing his finger at her like he was aiming a sword at her heart.
I had nothing to do with your war against the Dark. Had you asked me for my help back when I arrived, I may have been on your side.
We would never ally with a spawn from Murmur, said the Warhammer man through a scowl. And I would never help a mass-murdering bastard who raises entire cities to the ground because a few men dare challenge his rule.
Ed pointed back and above him at the columns of smoke rising from the city and feeding the storm clouds.
You did this!
His arm was shaking with rage. He forced his evil eye off and took a deep breath.
Whatever happens now is on you. Get the fuck out of my city, you piece of shit. If any of you ever come back, I will kill you. That's all the warning you get.
Ed turned to Gloriosa.
Get every prisoner you have and hand them to these people. Do not attack if they drop the shield to get them inside, but open fire if they take a single step out or attempt to cast a spell. According to their own rules, we could have infested their friends with mind-brood larvae, so they must kill them to be safe. Let's see if they have the stones to do to themselves what they so freely do to others.
Barthany scoffed.
Tall talk for someone with a few hours to live. Enjoy Undercity while you can, Dungeon Lord. There's 100 heroes out there, purging your evil from the land. The lives of all the good men you've killed today will be avenged by the end of the night.
Only if I lose, Ed said. If I win, and I intend to win, then your main advantage against me is gone. You know how to operate the heroes, and you may even know how to create them, but you don't know how they work, or how to upgrade them. Whatever computing equipment you have in Halagese is all you have left. Well, I doubt you know how to troubleshoot a computer, and you better pray to Alita I don't figure out this machine's password, or you may wake up one day being Ivalice Online's new villains.
He handed the laptop to one of his Haganashi.
Get this to the Haunt.
His minions hurried to follow his command, and the piles of webbed and paralyzed bodies slowly piled up as the horned spiders came and went in all directions. Meanwhile, the Haganashi kept their blowpipes and bows aimed at the bubble, most of them at the spellcaster, who bit his lip and examined the scene, deep in thought. He seemed to reach a decision. He looked back over his shoulder.
When I drop the shield, get everyone you can inside. Don't put a foot outside the circle. If they attack us, I'll activate the circle and leave you stranded.
You wouldn't dare,
bellowed Warhammer.
Harmon, be reasonable. You cannot retake the city if you're dead,
Barthany pleaded.
The heroes will handle it, as always. Let's use this chance to regroup and gather our strength.
Ed lacked the time to stand by and watch. Now that his chances at making peace with the summoned hero were gone forever, time was of the essence. He turned to leave. At that moment, someone clapped behind his back. Everyone in the garden turned to see a mauled man painfully shuffle his way into the garden. His face was a mess of multicolored bruises, and his torn shirt was bloody. Two Kuftar darts protruded from his shoulders. His right leg had a slash above the knee, and he needed to use the Haganashi spear he carried as a walking stick. Despite all this, he moved with such confidence that he was halfway to Ed before his spider warriors realized the man was an inquisitor and began to close in on him. Ed raised a hand, gesturing at them to stop.
I was wondering when you'd appear, inquisitor,
he told Gallio. A curtain of rain fell across the city, buffeted by heavy wind. The inquisitor and the dungeon lord faced each other, surrounded on one end by Ed's minions and on the other by the Inquisitors protected by Hatter's magic. Ed drew his sword, but kept it aimed down for the moment.
So, "You're killing Inquisitors now,"
Gallio shouted, as to be heard over the storm.
"I figured the day would come, but it still pains me to see it."
"Isn't that Chieftain Cagleshire's spear?"
Ed asked.
"You are allowed to kill him, but we cannot defend ourselves."
The Haga Anashi jerked to attention at the news. A few of them had recognized the spear already. Some began to move toward Gallio, rage shining in their eyes. Ed showed them his open palm.
"Stop. He's mine."
Gallio shook his head.
"I regret what I had to do. But I was fighting to save innocent lives, and I'm fighting to keep your dear Inquisitors from killing any more innocent people,"
Ed said. Other than them, the entire garden had gone quiet.
"And earning a city in the process is only a happy side quest."
"That's right. Are we going to talk all day? Because you're in the way of my conquering."
Gallio shook his head sadly.
"I look at you and can barely see the young man I met in Barova. You stand like a dungeon lord, friend Edward, and even talk like one. Proud, powerful, dark. The sun wave would tear you apart in a second."
"If you still had spells for the day, you'd have used them already,"
Ed said, chuckling mirthlessly, a sound that was lost in the storm. He raised his sword at the Inquisitor in challenge.
"You can barely move, Inquisitor. Get out of my way."
Out of the corner of his eye, Ed could see that Hatter had dropped the shield while he thought Ed wasn't watching. The Inquisitors this time chose the rational approach and instead of jumping out of the circle to their deaths were hurrying quietly to drag the webbed prisoners inside. Gallio, who was facing the circle, had to be aware of this, so he was probably buying time in case Ed changed his mind.
"Will you kill me if I don't, Edward?"
the Inquisitor asked. Ed blinked.
"I should," he thought.
He was perfectly aware that if he let Gallio and the others go tonight, they'd come back to bite him in the ass later when they'd recovered. They wouldn't care that he'd showed them mercy. If the places were switched, right now, he'd either be dead or subject to unthinkable torture. A rational villain would have just killed the plucky adventurers and been done with it. Back on Earth, Ed, Mark, and Lisa always made fun of the bad guys who had their heroes at their mercy early in the game's story, and then allowed them to leave either by pride or incompetence. Usually both. Ed only needed to give the order. These assholes weren't even plucky adventurers. By letting them leave, he'd be risking the lives of more innocent people. The Dungeon Lord opened his mouth.
"Is that how I think of myself now?" he thought suddenly. "As the villain?"
Sure, the Inquisition insisted he was. The rest of the world insisted he was. But the Haunt thought otherwise. His friends thought otherwise. They were so sure in their conviction that right now they were out there, putting their lives at risk because they believed that what they were doing was worth it. How would they feel if they could see him right now? He'd seen Corgoron's futures. One of them was gone, erased by objectivity. And the other two ended with him alone, one way or the other, having sacrificed or lost his everything along the way. Corgoron had shown him his future, but not the Haunt's, because in her futures, the Haunt had none. And that would not do. Even if Gallio was right, even if he was more in tune to the dark now than ever, Ed could at least strive to be half the man Kleck believed him to be. With this decision, it was as if some heavy weight was lifted from his shoulders. Corgoron's future had been only a possibility. It was on Ed to build the one he wanted, not some shady artifact owned by Princess of Hell. And the card in Ed's pocket showed three men, not two. The summoned hero was gone, but Gallio was still alive. Even if Ed couldn't fathom a way for Gallio and himself to ever work together. Well, a practical villain would execute the Inquisitor because, after all the pain and death they'd inflicted on each other, it was a given that Gallio would fight him one day and possibly kill him. So, executing the Inquisitor while he was weak and unable to cast the Sunwave was the rational approach. But sometimes heroes had to take a leap of faith, and between opting to be a rational villain or a hero, Ed knew what option the guy who arrived at Ivalice with clear eyes and a clean conscience would have chosen. Ed smiled and raised his sword in challenge.
"I'll kill you myself, Inquisitor, right where you stand, with all your friends watching."
After all, he couldn't just let Gallio go. The Inquisitors would suspect that the man was allied with the Dungeon Lord. So, Ed had to get creative. And he seemed to recall Gallio having a personal talent that allowed him to read people when they lied to him. Gallio blinked, then paled. He grasped the spear with both hands.
"In that case, we don't have anything else to say to each other."
Then he launched Cagleshire's spear right at Ed's face with blinding speed.
"Gallio, no!"
Hatter screamed. Ed shifted his weight to the side and pivoted in place, throwing his left arm up and closing his hand into a fist. He caught the spear by the shaft and was driven backward a step by sheer momentum. And then Gallio was in front of him, brandishing a nicked short sword that had seemingly come out of thin air.
"So, you're not as wounded as you acted after all," Ed thought as the Inquisitor launched a stab aimed at his neck.
Sparks flew as Ed drew a lazy arc with his sword and parried Gallio's blade with the flat of his, pushing it away only enough for both blades to miss his neck by millimeters.
"Stone pillar!"
Ed roared, aiming at a spot behind him and counting down in his head. Gallio tried to tackle him while at the same time wrestling to drive both swords against Ed's neck, but Ed was expecting it, and no matter how ironclad Gallio's will, the Inquisitor was only running on fumes, while the Dungeon Lord was fresh and burning with energy. Ed elbowed Gallio in the jaw with his sword arm, then stepped forward and into the Inquisitor's tackle, throwing his left shoulder under the Inquisitor's chest and shooting upward using his back, in a motion not unlike a bull launching a bullfighter into the air. Gallio landed on his chest and rolled away, trying to right himself, but the ground underneath him rose up as if the earth itself was trying to punch the Inquisitor out. He flew backward, hands uselessly reaching for the sky. At the same time, the pillar stood in the way of the couple of Inquisitors, including the Warhammer Man, forcing them to remain put for a brief second.
"That's for Cagleshire," Ed told Gallio as he landed on his ass.
Only a few feet away from Hatter's magical circle.
"Now's our chance!"
the spellcaster screamed.
"Get him!"
The Inquisitors didn't waste a moment. Two of them jumped out of the circle and dragged Gallio in at about the same time the Haga Anashi's dart struck them. Ed opened his mouth to order his men to stand down, but it was too late. A volley of arrows flew through the air just as Hatter's hand struck the circle's runes and a blinding flash engulfed the garden. The arrows flew around the stone pillar, past the now empty circle, then harmlessly bounced off of the wall behind. Ed and his minions stood in silence in the deserted mansion, rain sliding down their faces, thunder roaring in the distance.
"Damn it all,"
Ed said, covering his head with his cloak as to hide his grin as rain dropped down his hair.
Foiled again.
Ed could feel his new dungeon grow through Undercity's entrails, bit by bit, tendril by tendril, avoiding certain areas and hurrying through others, always moving, always avoiding an unseen enemy. In a way, it was like watching the spread of a virus from afar. Kes and the others were at the farthest point, leading the charge, risking their lives to save the city. As Ed stood at the highest point of the mansion's wall while his troops finished their retreat, Ed could guess where Kes was headed. A black tower like a needle rising up among the smaller guilds of the merchant district. That would make for a fine spot for the jamming tower. It was also heavily defended. Since it was located near Undercity's downtown, most of the heroes would be there, as well as the Griffin Riders not currently headed back to Mulesius. Ed knew that, all across his homeworld, players everywhere would be waiting for the endgame of the world event to show up. The final boss, the one that a lucky party would face to finish the storyline.
Well, better not keep them waiting. If they wanted a boss fight, then Ed would give them one to remember. "I'm afraid I'll need your help once more, Queen Gloriosa," Ed told the albino queen.
He pointed at the black tower in the distance,
That's where I'm headed. That's where the haunt rises or falls.
Then it's an honor to be a part of our history,
Gloriosa said, polite as always, like only royalty could be. Ed climbed up the Spider Queen and then turned to his troops, who were waiting outside the mansion's walls.
We're headed toward the city center. There's no time to lose, so anyone not fast enough to follow should hide until it all blows over,
he told them, his voice booming through the storm.
I'm not going to lie. Most of us will be dead by the end of the night. Out there,
he raised his sword up into the air,
is a world that believes we're little more than pests to be rid of and forgotten about. Tonight, that changes. Tonight, we're not hiding anymore. Let's teach the Inquisition that it's them who should fear us.
And with that, without turning to see if they were following, Ed and Gloriosa rode for the heart of Undercity, skittering through rain and thunder past the great parks of Mulesius, down the grassy hills and white-paved paths that separated it from the rest of the city, and then into tight streets partially flooded. In the distance, Ed could see his dungeon still growing, the tunnels reaching for the ground beneath the tower like a drowning man reaching for the shore. He rummaged through his belt, found a vitality potion, and downed it. At once, his body perked up as energy flooded into him. He was going to need it.
We may get intercepted along the way,
Gloriosa warned him.
My brood isn't exactly hard to spot from above.
Ed's eyes shone with the evil eye as he activated his dungeon vision as soon as he entered into contact with the dungeon below.
Don't worry about that, he said, as his view rose and rose until they were but a small, pale dot running through a labyrinth of streets and alleyways. I'll tell you exactly where to go.
He could see Gloriosa's cluster following after them like a white tide, and the Haga-Anashi running among them, fast and nimble, eager for one last fight. Chapter 29. Tower Defense.
Three Necros on our tail,
Lisa said, her fingers dancing across the keyboard with practiced agility.
They're comboing Rot Cloud with weakness to disease. Zombie-enhancing auras are up. We're probably heading into an ambush. Omar, mind fireballing that open sewer over there? The last zombies came from under the city.
She countered the weakness to disease with a couple blessings, targeting Omar and Ryan and trusting Mark and herself to resist the curses on their own. Lisa used that extra time to blow the rot cloud away with a storm wind. Since Undercity registered rain and heavy winds, the spell was empowered enough to blow the sickly brown cloud back to the necromancers, who coughed as tears of pixelated blood oozed down their cheeks. Omar threw a blind fireball down the sewer, and parts of zombies flew out. Lisa grinned. Before the necromancers had time to recover, Rylan Silverblade was among them, Lisa's blessings protecting him momentarily from the cloud. The rogue disemboweled the necromancers using sneak attack, scimitars shining a muted purple. All things considered, thin men running around in tunics were not that hard to kill, once you got up close and personal.
This is the most fun I've had in months,
Mark said.
They just keep coming.
It was as if Pantheon had given up all semblance of realism, because the sheer variety of creatures they'd fought all over the city was staggering. Horned spiders, thieves, elite Kuftar, assassins, cultists and necromancers, lots of undead. She'd even seen a vampire flying nearby. An unlucky group of Batblins, corrupted watchmen, ogres, witch doctors, pirates, smugglers, and many more. Usually a dungeon kept to a single group of creatures or one solid theme, but this was why world events were so fun. The city was throwing so much shit at them that even high-leveled heroes like them were running out of potions and daily powers. Lisa estimated that about a third of the original parties had been taken out as the event started, but even old players that hadn't logged on in a while were now joining in as their friends called them up. It wouldn't be long until the city was theirs. The only question on everyone's mind was, who would be the first to have a crack at the final boss? After all, that was where the best loot was found. And, of course, the bragging rights, which were just as important. The only thing marring her enjoyment was that not everyone in the group had fun under pressure. And Ryan was the kind of guy who made sure that, If he wasn't having fun, no one else would.
Damn it, Lisa!
He squeaked over the chat.
That cloud shit ruined my damn endurance! Why didn't you use Ockrath's might instead?
Lisa rolled her eyes, feeling like a balloon had deflated inside her chest.
I spent it on Mark so we could keep aggro on the mutated crocodiles. I told you that 3 times.
If he'd waited only a bit longer for the cloud to disperse, he wouldn't have gotten the debuff. But he'd wanted to get the damn kills himself.
Learn how to play! Mark's job is to tank! If he can't do it without your buffs, then that's his problem!
Rylan Silverblade advanced forward, closer to the city center, forcing the other 3 players to follow him before they had time to heal back up to full, because otherwise they'd split the party and Ryan would blame them. It had been like that since the beginning.
Come on!
He hollered.
The boss is right after this corner, I just know it!
Instead, they reached an area already scoured clean by other players. It was a merchant district, judging by the size of the houses and the markets. Lisa could see a few remaining heroic parties hanging around, replenishing their HP and searching for loot or hidden enemies. She checked her quest log and found a small alert that called all available heroes to the Mulesius district, an area whose access had been previously blocked so far. It made sense as a location for the final battle.
I think we went the wrong way,
she pointed out, growing more frustrated by the second. There was no way they'd reach Mulesius in time. She'd been looking forward to that boss fight so badly. After all the shit she had to deal with on a daily basis, the weird sensation of being watched at night, Ryan's bullshit, her inability to land another job, even things like Ed's disappearance. It was strange. A part of her seemed to believe that if she could only have one more evening of honest fun, like the old times, when she was young and without a care in the world. One more night like that and she'd be able to deal with her shit, to finally do what needed to be done, the things she'd been postponing for so long. But of course, that chance was now gone. She'd have to spend the night listening to Ryan whine.
You know, you could have gone by yourself,
a small part of her thought.
What are you waiting for? Someone else to give you permission? It's been like this for years, Lisa. At some point, you need to start making your own decisions and living with them.
She bit her lip, hard enough to draw blood. Sure, going against Ryan's orders would make her lose her job, probably. But was that so terrible? Many people had periods of unemployment they couldn't afford and managed to power through them. She'd always known that. In a way, it had been her own fear keeping her at Laser Shark.
Damn it!
Ryan was saying.
You guys took too damn long to clear the city, and you should have read the log earlier. It's all your fault, you useless noobs!
Sorry, Ryan,
Omar said sheepishly. Her cursor hovered over Rylan Silverblade's character. A right click opened a small window. She paused over the leave party option.
Let's go,
Ryan said.
Maybe the boss will defeat the first groups and we could take a shot at him still.
Hating herself, Lisa closed the small window and went after the rogue, following Mark and Omar. Perhaps she'd handle her shit later. Right now, all she fucking wanted was a chance at one last fun evening, no matter how unlikely that was. They were almost out of the district when the Hell Chickens arrived. Everywhere Kes went, the drones dug underneath, stealing every uncontested inch of Undercity for the haunt. Bit by bit, the tunnels of a new dungeon grew, like the roots of a tree spreading through the ground year after year. The new dungeon had its seat in the middle of the undead-infested catacombs under the city. Kes even had the drones tunnel straight out of those catacombs into heroic-controlled areas to divert them away from the innocent citizens, buying time for Laurel and her cluster to get the civilians to safety, usually straight into the recently vacated catacombs. Kaga and the monster hunters followed behind her, keeping to the shadows, blowpipes and crow familiar runes at the ready to keep the griffin riders at bay. It was clear by now that the flying inquisitors were looking for Kes's group. The haunt's presence hadn't gone unnoticed. With her avian vision, she could see the silhouettes of half the Griffin riders encircling the slums head back toward Mulesius Heights, braving the growing storm as they did so. On the ground, many heroic teams headed that way as well, leaving Ed's drones free to overtake the devastated territory they left behind. Whatever Ed and the Haganashi were doing in Mulesius Heights, Kes hoped they'd leave soon. Since the heroes hadn't stopped their attack, she could guess the Dungeon Lord hadn't been successful on his personal quest. At least, since she was still bound by minionship to him, it meant he was still alive. For now.
"Backs to the wall!"
she ordered, holding up a fist to stop her guards. Behind her, Kostel barked her words at the rest of the squad, who hurried to obey. Not one second after young Ivan had hidden himself under the shadow of a roof's overhang, five Griffin riders flew in formation straight above them, circling the area. Kes didn't move a muscle until the Inquisitors were out of sight, ignoring the cold that seeped into her bones. In this, the storm was a blessing in disguise. The rain and the darkness hid them better than most spells could have, and the winds forced the griffins to fly low, making them vulnerable to runic fire, as well as tiring them and their riders. Rasvan coughed and cursed under his breath.
"I cannot see my own hands in this rain!" he exclaimed. "Where are you taking us, Marshal?"
Kes realized that her guards could barely move under the rage of the wind. The monster hunters weren't faring much better. For all their training, brawn wasn't their strong suit. Hers either. But she knew that stopping meant certain death.
"Over there!"
She pointed at a black structure in the distance, at least twice the size of any building nearby.
"That's where we're headed."
"That's the Charcoal Tower," Kaga warned her. "It's the Akathunian headquarters, a den of villainy like no other. According to our spiderling's reports, the entire district is overrun by heroes wanting to take a shot at the assassins. I doubt we can get anywhere close to it."
"Well, we'll need to figure something out,"
Kes said.
"The dish needs to be high up for it to work properly. Otherwise, the city's buildings will interfere with it. No, Kostel, we cannot have the drones build a new tower,"
she said, reading the question in the guard's eyes.
"We don't have materials, and it'd take too long anyway. It'll be better if we use the Charcoal Tower. Easier to defend."
At least, that's what she hoped. The main problem with building a new tower were the damned Griffin Riders. As soon as they saw the drones working on it, they'd realize something was up, and then they'd rain fireballs upon them. The Akathunian headquarters was an old structure meant to withstand a siege. From the watch or from the king's officers, it didn't matter. Heroes or no heroes, it was the best shot they had. And they were running out of time. She threw a glance back, wondering if she'd be able to see Alder and Levy approach. She'd left a couple drones behind to guide them on the right path, but in the confusion of combat, who knew if the drones would find her friends? She hurried her pace, trusting her men to follow. They soon left the safety of the paved narrow streets and reached the luxurious merchant districts, the most affluent area in Undercity. Not counting Mulesius Heights, where the ultra-rich and the royalty resided, but which was technically a different city in all but name. Kes arrived at the ample, well-lit streets and open parks with clear paths. They were fine for having a safe stroll at night during a normal day, but deathly dangerous tonight when her best ally was darkness and stealth. Her first instinct was to have the drones dig a tunnel straight to the tower so they could bypass the open ground, but the drones shook their heads when she gave them the order. One pointed its tiny finger at a few shadows who were standing in the middle of the main plaza without a care in the world.
"Heroes,"
Kes thought. Not everyone had left for Mulesius then.
"Their presence is contesting the district."
"We'll need to fight our way inside,"
Kaga said. Next to him, Yumiya nodded grimly.
"A fitting end, to die fighting an impossible battle."
Kostel and the other humans didn't look half as sure as the Kuffdar. For once, Kes agreed with them. She counted about five heroic parties standing around, healing or breaking all crates and barrels in sight.
"We've got Pyrene on standby. Have the Spiderlings tell her we may need some reinforcements in a few minutes."
Someone tugged at her arm.
"Marshal?"
asked young Ivan. He had a worried look to his eyes.
"Any chance that Pyrene decided to charge on her own?"
Kes didn't like the kid's expression one bit.
Empress Laurel gave her strict orders to wait, so I doubt she'll take the initiative,
she said. Then, frowning, she asked,
Why?
Young Ivan turned back and pointed at the avenue from where they'd just come a few minutes ago.
Because a lot of things are coming our way, and they look pissed off.
At first, Kes didn't know what he was talking about. Her sight wasn't as good in the storm. But then she saw a red glint here and there, like shining blood droplets floating in the dark. Then she heard the distant box, almost entirely muffled by the rain, but growing stronger with each second. There was a lot of balking, actually. And then lightning struck nearby, and the night became day for a flash, and Kes saw the army of hell chickens charging their way, steel beaks shining an evil blue. There was murder in their eyes. She could swear she also saw a pair of terrified spellcasters riding their own hell chickens, leading the charge if only by a few feet.
Oinus's bountiful mercy,
Kostel whispered.
What in the wetlands is that?
Kes didn't bother with an answer. The hell chickens were getting closer, fast. She turned to the nearby buildings that surrounded the plaza. The nearest one was about 100 meters away, and the first heroic parties were already heading to meet the hell chickens.
Get to that rooftop, everyone!
She bellowed, running as fast as her legs could go.
And don't you dare leave that dish behind!
The feeling of oxygen rushing into his battered lungs was glorious, even as it seared his throat and filled his mouth with the taste of ash. Carmack coughed and spit cold water. His entire body ached, except his right arm below his shoulder, which he couldn't move at all. He waded through the canal's waters, grabbing on to a sort of wide, black log with many spindly branches coming out of it and a long spike at one end. A silver thread was tied to the log, and it connected all the way to the group of inhuman figures waiting at the shore, partially hidden by the rainstorm. They seemed to be pulling the thread toward them, dragging Carmack to dry land. Beside him, Pris was in a similar situation. She was unconscious, or that was what Carmack hoped. Her lips were blue, and her skin deathly pale. Then he saw the log that was carrying her and realized it was no log at all, but a horned spider. He tried to scream, and a wave of pain dragged him back into unconsciousness. When he next awoke, he was lying on his back against the stones of a causeway. He was shivering from cold and fear, and there was a giant horned spider staring him down with her multiple beady eyes, her mandibles half open to reveal slick fangs capable of tearing open a horse in a couple bites. Carmack whimpered.
Fear not, meatbag,
the spider hissed.
For I am Laurel of the Haunt, first empress among spider kind. In the name of Dungeon Lord Wraith, I give you my word that you shall not be harmed, no matter how delicious you are.
She seemed as confused by this as Carmack was. Something told the thief that he was the Empress's first rescue attempt.
My thanks, Empress,
he stammered through clenched teeth. He was so cold. Glancing down, he realized the horned spiders had webbed the charred mess that was his arm. How thoughtful of them. It didn't hurt at all, somehow. Perhaps they'd given him a pain-numbing potion. Pris, right next to him, came to. She opened her eyes, took stock of the situation, and began to scream.
Quiet, meatbag!
Laurel bellowed.
The heroes will hear you screeching!
Carmack dragged himself next to his friend, who was about to suffer a hysterical breakdown.
Pris, listen! No, put the dagger down! They're on our side! I think they're working for Ed.
That was enough to get her attention, but she kept the dagger aimed at the Empress. Not that it'd help. Carmack knew horned queens were big, but Laurel was on a whole other level. Behind her, dozens of horned spiders of all sizes shifted nervously in place, their chitin glinting as the storm struck their bodies.
What are you talking about?
Pris muttered. She couldn't stop shivering. Carmack hurried to put an arm across her back, ignoring the violent pangs of pain near his shoulder. Pris seemed to consider stabbing him instead of the Empress, but then thought better of it and huddled closer. A tiny sliver of body heat fostered between them like a spark trying to keep the darkness from engulfing it.
"Think about it," Carmack said. "It's not like we didn't have our suspicions. The ease with which he bypassed the walls, the tunnels, the Kuffdars, and the Inquisition has been searching the countryside for a dungeon lord, one who fought a wraith. Makes sense, doesn't it?"
Pris grimaced.
"No, that sounds like admitting we've been aiding a dungeon lord this entire time. And that's just not my style."
"Enough!"
said Empress Laurel.
"We must leave before it's too late. Can you walk on your own, or should I have you webbed?"
The thieves didn't feel like walking, but they knew enough about horned spiders to instantly express, wordlessly, that they'd rather die than to allow themselves to be webbed. The two hobbled together, arms over the other's back, while Laurel's cluster skittered out of the causeway. They headed south, parallel to the western gate, while doing their best to keep away from that direction. On their way, Carmack saw more horned spiders from different clusters, as well as Kuffdar and Batblins. They were all working together, helping the survivors away from danger. Whoever couldn't stand was carried. Kuffdars and Batblins entered the houses, ushered out whoever was inside, and then the spiders webbed all entrances shut. In fact, Undercity had begun to look dangerously like a spider den, with thick webs closing off narrow streets and hanging from trees and lamps. It was as if they were trying to keep something away from this general area, but Carmack knew the webbing would do little to stop the heroes. "What then?"
"Carmack,"
Pris whispered.
"Look."
She pointed at one side street whose walls were enclosed by web. There was movement behind, a pair of creatures that looked vaguely like huge, murderous birds with beaks like cruel steel daggers.
"We better hurry,"
one horned spider of Laurel's cluster told them.
"You don't want to be here when they figure out that our webbing doesn't stop their claws."
"What are those?" Carmack asked, dreading the answer.
"They are the Haunt's favorite meal,"
said the spider.
"But they also have other uses."
In the distance, Carmack could see a lone heroic fighter being slowly devoured by a pack of those black birds, limb by limb. The fighter killed many, but it only seemed to incense the birds. There was a flash of light when a beak struck the hero's eye, and the construct disappeared as the runes of a summoning circle floated around him and teleported him away, leaving behind a very disappointed group of birds. It would have been funny, except that they then turned Karmic's way. They had red eyes, with pupils like those of a cat, predatory and hungry. The thief realized that he could walk much faster after all. All things considered, Alder was having a pretty rough night. To start, his throat was sore from all the screaming, and he was pretty tired from keeping his nimble feet melody up for so long. As he and Levy charged their way through Undercity, he didn't dare turn back to see what exactly was following behind. He kept his eyes focused forward on the nearby future and on the most important question on his mind. How was he going to stop, exactly, once they reached their destination? Having Bloodfiend simply stop running didn't seem like the best of ideas, given that the Hell Chickens chasing after them didn't intend to stop, which left him at his wit's end. All his life, he'd never before gotten himself into a situation that couldn't be solved by going the other way as fast as possible. He grimaced. Being a hero definitely wasn't his thing. How did Kes, Ed, and Kleck make it seem so easy? At the very least, he wasn't alone in his suffering. The only remaining illusion was of Levy, and it was running next to him, with the real Levy riding on the opposite side, carrying one of Ed's drones in front of her like she would a small child. He was flanked by twin witches, equally terrified. If he could only live long enough to write that down.
"Over there!"
Levy called, while her drone gestured in the general direction of a black tower in the distance.
"That's where Kes is!"
"Fantastic! I hope she's up to stopping a few hundred Hell Chickens on her own!"
The witch shook her head no, a motion that the illusionary version imitated a second later.
"Don't worry about the chickens!"
Levy exclaimed.
Why not? It seems like a huge deal to me,
Alder called back, pushing his throat to make his voice be heard over the storm.
Because,
Levy yelled,
those assholes in front of us are probably going to kill us before the hell chickens can.
Alder raised an eyebrow. He could barely see anything at all in front of him. Salty, cold water kept stinging his eyes.
What assholes?
Then he saw the heroes strolling through an open plaza to meet them, magic crackling in the spellcaster's hands, enchanted weapons at the ready. He couldn't help but quote Ed.
Oh, shit!
Time to split!
Levy roared, pushing Scar's reins to the side. The Hellchicken followed, with Bloodfiend close behind, just as the first couple fireballs soared past their heads and vaporized a pair of Hellchickens behind them. Almost as an afterthought, Alder willed Levy's illusionary copy, which was heavily doused in pheromones, to charge straight at the nearest party of heroes. Alder looked over his shoulder in time to see a knight with a broadsword hack off the heads of three chickens at once, and then be swarmed by their battle-lusted brethren. The witch's illusionary copy disappeared under a barrage of ice bolts a second later.
Over there!
Levy said, gesturing to one end of the plaza, at a two-story building with broken windows and a partially caved-in entrance. There was the faint afterglow of a lantern shining on a balcony, and Alder could see Kess's figure frantically gesturing for them to come closer. Ice bolts flew right over the bard's head. He squeaked and hugged Bloodfiend to make himself a small target. His mount gave him a sharp, judgmental bock and rushed after Scar, wading through a sea of angry hellchickens and wounded heroes teleporting away. Just as Levy reached the walls of the building, she threw her hands above her head and was snatched up by the furry arm of a kuftar hanging from the edge of the balcony. To Alder, it looked as if she was engulfed by darkness itself. It happened so fast.
No, no, no!
With a supreme effort of will, the bard shoved down his terror and let go of the reins. He straightened his back and raised his hands as high as possible. The kuftar's hand closed in on his. Alder's shoulders screamed in protest, and suddenly his legs left the hellchicken's back as the kuftar used Alder's own momentum to throw him upward using some sort of acrobatic talent. For an instant, Alder flew up a few inches through the air. He saw Kess's face right in front of him as the marshal caught him by the waist and tossed him onto the wooden balcony. More hands dragged him inside the safety of the building. The bard caught a glimpse of Bloodfiend and Scar rushing away from the plaza, moving faster now that they'd lost their riders. Alder spat rainwater onto the floorboards. He was soaked down to the bone. Around him, Kostel and her guards covered the building's entrances. Kess squatted next to a broken window to watch the plaza, the surviving drones huddled around Levy's dish, and Kaga and the monster hunters stood around Alder.
The pheromones work?
Yumiya inquired.
Too well, I'd say, Alder said. I'd rather have them their usual angry selves than lusty and angry.
Outside in the plaza, the heroes and the hellchickens fought a bloody, terrible battle. The spellcasters spammed crowd control magic while keeping their tanks as buffed as possible, and the haunt's black creatures fell in droves. But there were only four or five heroic groups in total, and there were hundreds of hellchickens, and only so much a tank could do when his team was flooded by a storm of murderous feathers and sharp beaks looking for the soft spots underneath their armor. Levy hurried to Kess's side.
The chickens won't last long, and more heroes are coming from Mulesius,
she told the marshal.
What's the plan? Is that tower tall enough for your dish?
Kess asked simply.
It'll have to be,
Levy said.
But I have no idea if it'll work, Kess. Folk and I didn't have enough time to test it.
Kess nodded.
That's the usual story with new gear. Let's hope for the best, Levy. But I swear if the thing explodes or fails to start, I'm going to grind it back into sand. Well, you're welcome to try. It's sturdier than it looks,
Levy said with a small grin. The marshal stood and gestured at Alder and the others to group around her. Alder did so gladly, stepping closer to the kuftar as to steal a bit of their body heat for himself. He was shivering enough not to mind the kuftar's wet dog smell.
Here's what we'll do,
Kess said.
We're going to reach that tower and bar it from the inside while the drones hook up the dish to the city's ley lines. Since the dish and the drones are our win condition, we're going to form a circle around them and head to the tower by hugging the walls as much as we can. Then we're going to run and hope for the best. Lavey, Alder, you're our spellcasters. Do you have any juice left to help us out?
Lavey nodded.
Spectres should come in handy. I mean, they always do. But hell chickens can't strike them, since their claws aren't magical. A zap or two from my specters should keep most of them away from us.
I'm down to 2 incantations,
Alder said. Keeping his illusions up all the way from the haunt had eaten through most of his spells.
I could nimble feet when it's time to rush, and save a dazzling display in case the heroes try to take a shot at us.
He was so tired that he wasn't sure he wouldn't pass out while using nimble feet again, but he kept that to himself.
Do it,
Kes said.
Everyone, take your positions. We'll leave as soon as the flow of battle leaves us an opening.
As the Kuftar, the guards, and the drones hurried to follow her command, she headed for the stairs, then seemed to change her mind. She strolled back to Alder and Lavey.
I'm proud of you two,
she told them.
Without the stunt you pulled with the hell chickens, we'd all be dead by now. Whatever happens next, I'm glad to be your teacher.
She left without waiting for a response. Lavey and Alder exchanged glances.
What was that about?
Alder said quietly.
She went all sentimental all of a sudden. I mean, it's nice, but she never does that unless she's drunk.
The witch smiled, but her lower lip was trembling a bit.
She thinks we're all going to die,
she said.
Oh,
Alder said. One famous dwarven philosopher had engraved a musing in stone that said when a brave dwarf drew his last breath, he'd see the silver gates of the great mountain slide open, and his ancestors and late family would storm out to greet him and shower him in cold ale and gemstone necklaces. They'd carry him inside the mountain palace, where he'd be bathed and his beard braided before a huge feast was served in his honor. If the dwarf had been craven, though, the gates would never open. The palace jester, an ugly creature that looked like a corrupted gnome, would appear to mock him, and the ground below the dwarf's feet would collapse and draw him all the way to the heart of the world, where his flesh would be stripped from his bones, and then his bones would melt and become part of the liquid steel heart of Ivalice itself, and the dwarf would burn until the world fire died out. This is all to say that when Oscor opened his eyes to see a weird amalgamation of a batblin and horned spider standing inches away from his face, he may have jumped to conclusions.
"Stay away from me, you damn jester!"
he roared, trying to drag himself away and punch the aberration at the same time, yet managing neither. Something was holding his legs in place.
"Sword off, you fuck! I'll fight you! I'll fight you and the entire damn palace!" Do you think I'm a coward, ancestors? Well, come at me then. I never liked you much anyway, you bunch of stuck-up pricks.
What a loud little snack,
said the spider half of the palace jester.
And it doesn't seem too happy about us saving his hide. Can I eat it now?
No, Tulip, said the batblin half. We don't eat the people we rescue, remember?
The horned spider seemed disappointed. Oscor blinked and did his best to clear the soot from his eyes with fists even dirtier than his face. He realized that the palace jester was, in fact, a batblin riding a horned spider princess.
So I'm only hallucinating,
he realized.
Not dead yet. Oh, sorry, ancestors.
The batblin jumped off of the spider.
Don't be afraid,
the critter told the dwarf.
My name's Kleck, and my friend here is Tulip. I am the leader of the Haunt's spider riders. Lord Ed sent us to help. You'll be safe now.
Lord Ed, eh?
The dwarf chuckled darkly to himself.
So that's why Ed is so weird. No wonder we're in this mess.
He turned to look around at the ravaged alley.
Where are my friends?
Right behind you, boss,
Scum said weakly. Oscor shifted painfully, still unable to move his legs. They were pinned down under a smoking beam. The fact that he wasn't in absolute agony at the moment worried him. Scum was surrounded by even more batblins riding spiders. There were about 4 more of them, all busy helping Oscor's smugglers get out of the debris or administering first aid. One spider webbed Chimeko's broken arm and bit her gently, using paralyzing venom to numb the pain. Oscor nodded in approval.
"We're ready,"
Kleck said. The Batblin had been busy somewhere outside of Oscor's field of view. When he reappeared, he was holding the end of several web